pleased to welcome you to this gathering today. Is that better? Good. Today we gather for the Harwick Lecture on Stewardship, which is sponsored by the Verna H. and Monroe B. Harwick Memorial Endowment Fund. This fund was established by Ray Harwick and his wife, Pat. Both Ray and Pat are active in the field of stewardship in the life of congregations and the wider church. They generously created this fund in order to sponsor lectures, classes, as well as convocations. Today, we turn our attention as good stewards to the question of the stewardship of theological education. We are pleased to welcome Ms. Barbara Wheeler, who is president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. She has been president since 1980, and she is also the director of the Auburn Center for the Study of Theological Education since 1991. Auburn Seminary is an institution associated and coming out of the Presbyterian Church. All of her life, her professional life, not her childhood, but all of her professional life, she has been working on issues of theological education, of women in theological education, and the present and future prospects of theological education in this country. One expression of that was her co-authoring the book, Being There, Culture and Formation in Two Theological Schools. It is a detailed analysis of the life of two seminaries and a wonderful insight into the nature of theological education. All institutions and communities need people who, by virtue of their study, their research, and their experience, understand their history, the way they live and think, and also their internal life. Barbara Wheeler knows of such things. She also cares about theological education, and I think she belongs to a wonderful class of people that even worries about theological education. For all of these reasons, it is my pleasure to welcome her and introduce her to you. She is going to speak on the topic Theological Education, A Dim and Hopeful View. Barbara Wheeler.
I need to tell you my favorite story about my own institution because it involves a figure who was critically important in the history of yours. Auburn Seminary wasn't always in New York City. It was founded in upstate New York in the town of Auburn on the frontier at the beginning of the 19th century. It was founded to offset the influence of another Presbyterian seminary a little farther south, to train ministers for the frontier who were theologically less picky and physically more hardy than those who had graduated from Princeton. Early in the 1840s, we had a visitor from Princeton, a seminary student who had been severely ill and for his health took a walking tour from Princeton, New Jersey to Schenectady, New York to visit Union College from which he graduated and then to the new seminary at Auburn. His name was John Williamson Nevin. When he got back to Princeton, he wrote a letter about his travels to his tutor at Union College. That letter remains in the Union College archive, and when I was appointed president of Auburn 20 years ago, somebody sent me a copy of it as a congratulatory gift. The letter from John Williamson Nevin says of our institution that it's growing fast, and it was. It had three professors. At that time, Princeton and Andover each had only two, and Nevin, who was a great theologian later but never a prophet, predicted that we would soon outstrip Princeton in size and prominence. And he noted that it cost half as much to attend Auburn Seminary as it did Princeton. That was deliberate. We were the Spartan Seminary. And then he entered his only reservation about the place. He said, and I quote, I've used this many times, "By the strict line of Calvinist orthodoxy, Auburn Seminary is a little swerved." He said, and he added, "And they, of course, deem the distortion to be on our part." I have adopted that as the motto of my presidency of Auburn. Auburn Seminary, a little swerved. Thank you, John Williamson Nevin. Here is a parable, Jesus' favorite teaching device. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, and he thought to himself, "What shall I do, for I have no place to store my crops?" Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God." In 1991, we established a center at Auburn Seminary, which since it moved to New York City and Union's campus, has been free to do things that need doing rather than some of the things that other seminaries do. We established a center at Auburn Seminary to study theological education. There's no other research institute in the world that does that. Our reasoning as we created this new research program was positive and cheerful and upbeat. It went something like this. Religious faith is self-evidently a good thing. Religious leadership that helps communities to deepen their faith and extend their benefits to the world is a high calling. Institutions that prepare people for this calling are doing a noble work, and therefore a research center that gives these theological institutions information to help them do an even better job would be a good thing. A valid institutional mission, and itself a noble work. That spirit which infused our center when it was established, this optimistic view that theological education is good and can only get better, that same spirit can be found in almost all public representations of theological education. Most of us presidents, for instance, give almost the identical speech to our graduates and their friends. Point one in the speech, your school has changed a lot since you were there. Point two, even though it's different, it's still a very good school. In fact, it may be even better than it was in your day. Point three, quality comes at a price. Send money. A bright outlook also infects what we seminary leaders say to the inner ring of our supporters, what we tell our boards and our administrative staffs and our faculty colleagues. Point one of that speech. This institution already has in place most of the institutional and programmatic arrangements it needs to get the job of theological education done right. Point two, we administrators, along with the board, We'll see to the last administrative and financial steps that need to be taken. While we do, faculty and students need to be patient, not to expect raises or funds for new programs anytime soon. And meanwhile, you, educational staff, faculty, take care of the educational side. Rearrange the pieces we have, add just a few others, not too expensive, please, and everything will be just fine. After 9 years of research at the Auburn Center on a wide range of topics, on the financing of theological education, on theological faculty and the doctoral programs that prepare them, on the educational culture of seminaries, on public perceptions of theological education, and most recently on seminary students. After 9 years of sustained research, I have increasing difficulty making those standard speeches. For most of this enterprise, things are not fine. Each of our center's projects has produced results that suggest that the long-term prospects of theological education are clouded. The situation of theological schools is serious enough that it is time to dispense with those usual speeches that make us all feel better and to talk instead about the way things really are. There are several trends and developments in theological education that are very worrisome. Peter's right. I do worry. You ask a Calvinist to come talk to Calvinists. We're going to worry together. I'm going to list the worrisome trends. They add up to what I've called a dim view of the theological education future. And then I will say something, and it will have to be very, very brief, about the broader developments in American society and religion in which I think those worrisome trends are rooted, for we in theological education are not alone. And last, I was asked to do this, last I'm going to specify what I think are the issues that this general situation of theological education and American religion poses for you. Lancaster Theological Seminary in particular, and I will set those challenges in the context of stewardship, which is framed for us in sharp terms by that passage I just read. Specifically, I'm going to ask how you, Lancaster Seminary, might be called now and in the future to be rich toward God. Before I get to your own situation, let us look first at the common lot of theological education these days, at the set of less than encouraging trends and conditions that affect most, if not all, theological schools. This list is not going to surprise members of the board of this institution who have been thinking about your future and those who've been talking with them. Three of the items on the list have already been identified in your most recent round of discussions as the priority for this seminary. And the fourth is an issue which I would venture that you think about and deal with on a regular, probably daily basis, even if you haven't yet named it in your planning. Worrisome trend number one. Theological education as an industry is in a financially precarious state, as are many individual schools. This is not news to you. Lancaster is one of the few theological schools that has faced the necessity of painful radical surgery on expenditures, that has bitten that bullet, and then has apparently held a steady course after initial fairly deep cuts, and has done that while reducing endowment drawdown at the same time. Anthony Ruger, who's the financial analyst who works for the Auburn Center and the world expert on seminary financing, has learned about the process you've just been through from Peter and from other sources. And when I told Tony that I was coming here to speak, he said, be sure you give them an A. What they did was very difficult. Very few seminaries have made those kinds of tough decisions and stuck with them. Tony does not give a lot of A's. in fact, through him and through others, through some of your publications, word that you have done this, that this institution cut its budget and lived. That word's gotten out, and we at the Auburn Center, who do a lot of consulting with seminaries, are actually asked from time to time, sometimes by very experienced seminary leaders, just how you did it. I know it wasn't easy. Perhaps it will be some retrospective comfort to know that many seminaries struggle with the realities you face so squarely, namely a financial present, which is very different from their financial past. Theological schools used to be very cheap to run. They were largely unregulated. They could skimp on facilities and services. They paid low salaries to employees that were bound to them by religious loyalties. And they could count on churches and denominations to pay many of the seminary's bills or to support the costs of students attending, or both. All that has changed. Accreditors and public agencies set the same standards for seminary buildings and services that other institutions of higher education have to meet. Seminaries compete on the open market for staff like development directors and website developers, and faculty who could be teaching in better-paying colleges. Denominational support is waning. Churches are much less likely to pay the way of their students to seminary. And on top of these conditions, seminaries are very, very small. One sharp observer said that the average seminary, which has about 12 full-time faculty and about 200 full-time equivalent students, more closely resembles in size and structure the long-vanished neighborhood grammar school than it does a contemporary graduate institution. Because seminaries are so tiny, economies of scale are almost impossible to achieve. And then all those other factors load on costs. So on a per capita basis, our schools are now some of the most expensive institutions to run in all of American higher education. It's not surprising, then, that the majority of schools are financially shaky. We have observed many signs of this in our research. Though seminaries are not yet as dependent on their students borrowing heavily as some other sectors of higher education, they are moving fast in that direction. When we last studied it, about 50% of all seminary students borrowed during seminary. Some of them large amounts, some of them moderate amounts. What we said to seminary leaders by way of conclusion to that study is seminaries are not yet as addicted to student loan funds for revenue as the colleges are, but they have inhaled. Student loan programs are captive to national politics. They could be reduced at any moment, and if they were, they would take many colleges and some seminaries with them. Many seminaries are drawing too heavily on their endowments in these comfortable market years. The history of financial markets, not to mention the experience of the last few weeks, suggests that there may be lean and hungry years to come. Many schools, about more than half, of all schools several years ago had the kinds of annual deficits that you wrestled into submission. You can't tell anymore because the reporting formats have changed. I suspect the actual figures haven't. The projections that we've made at the Auburn Center suggest that because of all these weaknesses, there is going to be big trouble for many theological schools if economic conditions turn in an unfavorable direction. Worrisome trend number two, it's not on your list, but I'll bet you've observed it. Faculty roles are changing in ways that threaten the integrity and educational impact of theological education. Everyone acknowledges that theological faculty, young and old, are able people. And it turns out from our research that many of the criticisms conventionally made of theological faculty are misplaced. They are not, for instance, as often charged, personally alienated from churches, most of them. The great majority are highly observant. They go to church. They worship regularly in congregations. They lead worship. And they invest additional weeks. I mean, the average is weeks spent each year in denominational and ecumenical activities. Nor has the study of religion swamped preparation in theological disciplines, as some other people fear. Most graduate students still do their study in one of the classic theological fields, and almost all of them say that they have at least a potential interest in teaching in a seminary or a religiously related institution. So some of those conventional fears about faculty turn out to be groundless. But our research turned up evidence of other problems that should be cause for concern, but that haven't yet attracted very much attention. The problems we saw are linked to a major shift in how we, as a whole society, view the professions. Not very long ago, in fact, when most of us made our own professional decisions, a profession was a social role in which occupation and vocation came together. You didn't decide to do medicine or ministry or seminary teaching. You decided to become a doctor or a minister or a professor. Profession was a whole identity. It demanded a certain character and spirit as well as knowledge and skills, and you assumed that identity usually for life, and reciprocally, institutions offered positions, sometimes also for life, into which you could grow into that identity. Now, however, the view of the professions is very much changed. In my terminology, they are being commodified. Increasingly, professionals see themselves as vendors of specialized services. If the market for your specialized skills goes sour, you get another one and you sell that. Your profession is now what you do. It's not who you are. And institutions, probably causing this change, have changed their view. They downsize, they outsource, they use consultants, independent contractors, service vendors, in other words, in place of professional persons with whom they establish long-term ties and to whom they offer opportunities for social leadership as well as professional practice. Occupation and vocation have come uncoupled. Commodification is going on in theological education, big time. Seminaries are more and more inclined to see the faculty role in commodity terms, asking how much course teaching and other services they can get for their money. And the answer is you can get a lot of courses from part-timers for the cost of a regular full-time faculty member. Seminaries have figured this out. In the last 20 years or so, the number of theological schools has increased about 15%. The number of full-time faculty in all theological schools has increased about 5%. Number of part-time faculty has increased 129%. That's commodification. In our study, we found that today's new faculty also participate in this trend. They see that institutions are less likely to make long-term commitments to them, so they hold themselves back from forming attachments to a vocational goal or to an institution. What they care about is their subject matter, rather than any larger institutional or vocational goal. A vocational goal, for instance, of shaping religious leaders for the future. No sense falling in love with that because you might not get to do it. You might end up teaching in a place where that's not what's going on. They school themselves so that they can teach and do research on the subject they love, and they can do it just about anywhere. This is happening throughout the society. Engineers, you know, will use their skills to build weapon systems or hospitals, depending on who will hire them. That's the individual side of commodification. Now, why is this shift in faculty role a problem? It's a problem because faculty are so important they are so central in the student's educational experience and not just in the classroom. This intensive study that Peter mentioned that we did of two theological schools that was published as a book called Being There. We, the team of us who studied these two schools and lived in them, found that for students, the faculty is the school. Most of us on the team had administrative roles, so this hurt for a while, finding out that students don't even notice most of the time who administrators are and what they are doing. The faculty, for them, is the school. And from faculty, they learn not only content, not only patterns of thought, they also learn attitudes and values, habits. They learn what kind of speech and behavior and dress, what tastes comport with the truth that the faculty are teaching. As the title of our book suggests, casual exposure does not convey this kind of educational impact. It takes being there in the classroom, but also outside of it, students and faculty together over a sustained period of time. If faculty only show up to teach courses on part-time contract, or if those who are present are narrowly focused on their subject matter and not on what this institution and its students are about, students are not going to learn what a school, and particularly a seminary, is there to teach, which is how to live. A faculty that is viewed by the institution or that views itself as a collection of educational service units is not in a position to form religious leaders for the future. At least at the moment, Lancaster seems to be resisting commodification. You have enough, maybe you have more than enough, full-time faculty for the size of the student body. A ratio, as I computed it, of about 10 to 1, which is 50% more lavish than the average mainline Protestant school. You list twice as many part-time as full-time faculty, but I strongly suspect that they are in ancillary roles where they should be, not teaching your core courses. If I'm right about both those things, then you get another A for balancing the budget and dropping the draw rate on your endowment without commodifying, without, that is, cutting too many full-time faculty and resorting to too many part-time ones. Worrisome trend number three. It is getting harder for theological schools to recruit good students. We have just completed at Auburn the first ever comprehensive survey of entering seminary students. It shows that seminary still attracts some remarkably fine students, but it's getting more difficult to do so. And the overall quality of students headed for ministry is not as high as it ought to be. Especially worrisome is the high average age of seminary students. It's about 35 now for Christian and Jewish schools in the aggregate. Why is this a focus of anxiety? It's a focus of anxiety for me because it means that the average seminary student, or we found that the average seminary student did not begin to consider seminary and ministry until after college. We ask that. When did you first begin to think about going to seminary? And the answer, the average answer, is 24.5 years. By the age of 24 and a half, the average future doctor is already in medical school, and the average future attorney has taken the LSATs and is making application to law school. In other words, the other professions are getting the first cut of college graduates. Ministers are now disproportionately drawn from those who were undecided in the years just after college and have been looking for a long period of time. And then some come from among those who are dissatisfied with that other profession that they found. And maybe some come because they weren't successful in it. This pattern is definitely a change from the past. A long-term study of career preferences of college seniors who are elected to Phi Beta Kappa showed that in the late 1940s, about 7% of those students Phi Beta Kappa seniors said that they were headed for ministry. It's exactly the same percentage that said they were going into medicine. When the study was repeated in the late 1980s, about 15% said they were going into medicine, and less than 1% said they were headed for ministry. As I've already noted, today's seminary students, some of them, young and old, are excellent. I'm less concerned about the students we get than about the ones that we don't get. And older students, I need to say this, bring a higher level of commitment to ministry than younger ones. Our studies showed that. And they also bring a lot of our much-needed gender, racial, and class diversity to the mix. But other students we take, old and young, have limited potential. And most of our institutions accept all those who apply regardless. Now, granted, some students are screened out before they even do the applying, but acceptance rates are so high that it needs to be said that almost anybody who graduated from college with less than a failing average can go to seminary somewhere. The median acceptance rate for Protestant seminaries is 87%. Which means that half of all seminaries accept more than 87% of the students who apply to them. Very few institutions now have a big enough applicant pool to accept only students about whom they can be enthusiastic. And most seminary leaders, if you get them late at night in a very candid moment, will tell you that their institutions would... almost all of their institutions now accept some students who show limited promise for ministry. Worrisome trend number four. Seminaries are increasingly isolated from other institutions of religious and social life. When we were first organizing the Auburn Research Center, we gathered seminary leaders and asked them what are the most serious problems of theological education, what they most wanted us to do research on. And we expected that they would emphasize issues that confront them every day, balancing the budget, recruiting students, tensions between faculty and administrators, fundraising. They mentioned all of these, but more than any of them, they emphasized their sense that their institutions are isolated and marginalized from the rest of what goes on in this society. Last year, it took us 10 years to figure out how to do it, but last year we conducted a study to test whether that sense is accurate. Researchers from Auburn spent 3 to 5 days in four cities. Three of those four cities had seminaries in them, several of them more than one. And while we were there, we interviewed the public. Clergy, church executives, lay leaders of congregations, and beyond the churches, social leaders from business, public service, higher education, the media, the nonprofit sector. Altogether, we conducted 111 interviews of 254 persons. And what we found is this. Beyond a very small circle of insiders, clergy, church executives, a few congregations in the seminary's own religious tradition, beyond that, theological schools are simply invisible on the wider social landscape. This did not come as a big surprise to me. I've been taking 3 or 4 airplane flights a week for the last 20 years. The person sitting next to you always asks you what you do, and if you tell that person that you're the president of a theological seminary, you have to watch them struggle for some association with that term. And figure out whether you're going to bail them out by telling them what this institution is. Almost nobody but our close friends knows that we're here. Here's a quotation from the president of a mainline Protestant denominational seminary that has occupied its large and beautiful campus in a small city for the better part of this century. The names have been changed here to protect the candid. Greenhurst Seminary, said the president, is still not as well known in this city as we could and should be known. A woman asked me what I did, and I told her I was president of Greenhurst Seminary, and she said, "Where is that?" And I told her on Greenhurst Drive, and she said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Well, yes, I'm sure." And she said, "Well, I've driven the length of it for 20 years, and I never knew that was there." Greenhurst Seminary is, we found, by no means unique. The obscurity of seminaries is a major threat to their well-being. Without much more knowledgeable and extensive constituencies, the long-term future of theological education is bleak. This last trend and others point to a set of changes in the character of American religious life that, in fact, underlie all of the worrisome trends I've cited. I don't need to spell these changes out in any detail because most of you, I am sure, have heard others speak about them. But let me just tick them off quickly. American religion's increasingly personal. In the ugly but accurate terms of sociologists, it is now much less often ascribed by birth and ethnicity and more often achieved by choice. You decide what religious identity you're going to put on, and brand loyalty is very low. We have become a nation of religious switchers, and often across the once unbridgeable Catholic-Protestant-Jewish divides, as well as among Protestant denominations. Religion here is also increasingly individual. Americans believe at a high rate, but more and more they don't align themselves with religious groups. Increasing numbers of people have joined denominations of which they are the only member. And this trend hits us mainline. Remember Sheila in Habits of the Heart? She belongs to Sheilaism, just my own little voice, she says. It hits us mainline groups very hard. We fantasize that those who are leaving our congregations are going out there to the edge of town to stricter, more conservative religious groups in big and fast-growing churches, but it's not true. Most people who leave mainline Protestant churches don't join any other religious group. They just stop going altogether. The biggest competition of a denomination like the UCC is the Sunday morning newspaper. Religion in this country is also increasingly private. The noisy and highly visible activities of a few professional religious activists notwithstanding, most evidence suggests that Stephen Carter's basic description of where American religion really is on the American scene is correct. You can believe whatever you like in this country as long as you keep it to yourself. Most of our fellow citizens want both persons associated with organized religion and the ideas it generates to be kept indoors, out of the public arena and out of the major institutions of religion and culture. Our recent study of public perceptions of theological education confirmed this in striking and even shocking ways. When we went to interview those social leaders who didn't know enough about theological education even to say anything about it, we had to ask them some other question. So we asked them to evaluate the religious institutions and leaders in their communities, thinking that that would constitute an indirect evaluation of the work of theological schools. What they told us is that those religious leaders seem almost entirely focused on taking care of their own congregations. They are not a significant part of the civic mix. With a very few exceptions, and most of those exceptions were African American, few of them were Jewish, but with those exceptions, religious leaders were just not on anybody's list of people you have to call to make things happen in that particular city or in that region. These developments are, for the most part, not good news for traditions like the one that you serve, the ones that you serve. Organized and established traditions, and if you've got a seminary this old, you are an organized and established tradition. We emphasize continuity. We expect our religious community to grow and develop, and we hope improve over time. This widespread tradition hopping undercuts that process of growth and improvement and change. Your official tradition, the UCC, has made congregations the central feature of its life, also relies on fairly strong connecting structures to increase the impact of congregations. Individualized, make-your-own religion weakens both local congregations and denominations dramatically. And your tradition has long been committed to a public presence. So the privatization of religion, like its personalization and individualization, is not moving things in your direction. I want to mention one additional set of developments that are different from these external forces and conditions because they're rooted inside our religious traditions. We face some major challenges to our strength and even survival in the present period. Mainline traditions are low. I have said this at length in other settings. Mainline religious traditions these days are low on what I call a piety, a term I use in an older sense, as Calvin did, to mean not outward religiousness, but a whole way of living. Some parts of it explicitly religious, but many not. A way of living that's consonant with what we believe. It's just no longer clear what patterns of life, what language, manners, styles, symbols, images, memberships, associations, any of it, are appropriate to and demanded of people who believe the kinds of things we do. We are searching for a piety, for ways to live in the contemporary world that bespeak our beliefs. One result of the piety vacuum is the situation that our recent study portrays. We heard not only that religious leaders don't matter much on the civic scene, but also that they have trouble articulating their religious traditions within their own congregations. Our clergy leaders don't reach us, we heard over and over, and we heard that same term from Catholics and Protestants, and among the Protestants, from mainline Protestants and evangelical ones as well. Why don't they reach us? There are different theories. Some think that theological education is too academic and not practical enough. Others think that it is too technical and not theological enough. Many people out there, I have to tell you, think that too many people are admitted to ministry who do not have the requisite intelligence or maturity for so complex an assignment. And they blame us for taking them. The church does not seem to be aware that the church selects its own ministers. They think that we do. But whatever the reason, it is pretty clear that our publics, in the church and beyond, think that we seminaries are not yet doing an adequate job of preparing church leadership. And I suspect they are right. Let me try to pull together these larger developments and the specific ones that affect theological education. I have said that the forces that bear down on mainline Protestants from the outside are mostly adverse. The problems of theological education that I listed before are rooted in those outside developments. The privatizing of religion has eroded the cultural and social status of religious leaders. So able people who want to make a difference gravitate to the other professions where they think they'll have more social impact. My own child would be an example of that. I've been talking to him about ministry since before he was born, but to accomplish the good purposes for which he thinks he was put on earth, having something to do with justice and equity, it seems to him that the law will give him far more opportunity than the ministry. That's why it's so hard for us to recruit students to seminary. Loosened loyalties to particular religious traditions and growing uninterest in any sort of organized religious practice closely parallel the individualistic attitudes that some young faculty come with. The diminished public status of religion helps to create that gulf that we seminary presidents feel between our institutions and the people who should be our allies and supporters. Meanwhile, inside our communities of faith, things are missing, or at least they're very badly unbalanced. The challenge for us is that Craig Dykstra, Lilly Endowment came up with this term. The challenge for us is rebuilding religion. For that, we need able, creative leaders who are well-schooled and deeply formed to shape ideas and organizational structures and habits of life for religious traditions that still have a great deal to contribute. Perhaps we have more to contribute than we remember much of the time. It's because we need leaders to meet this challenge, to rebuild religious traditions, that Lancaster has to solve the problems of students, faculty, money, and connections that I mentioned earlier. What specifically should you do? I have two steps to suggest to you. These are aimed directly at the trustees, but the rest of you have the opportunity to cooperate with them. Both of them entail varieties of stewardship. The first step is more obvious. It's shorter term. The other will require you to look further into the future and to ask that question about what God is asking of you. First step is to continue doing what you have been doing. Continue to exercise good stewardship in the conventional sense. Continue to do the kind of thing that the rich man did so well in that parable, amassing ample resources and making adequate provisions, building barns, if you like, and by that I mean not only buildings, but also organizational structures and procedures, coming up with ways to safeguard the resources. The parable of the rich man, interestingly, is often used against the building of church and institutional endowments, as if it's not right to have stored provisions. But I think that's a misapplication of it. The rich man's mistake was not acquiring assets or even arranging for their safe storage. His mistake was his decision not to distribute them at the right time for the good purposes that they could accomplish. Lancaster, as you no doubt know, needs to build its endowment. If this is what money means on that list of requisites for the future that somebody gave me from your board discussions, you listed money, students, and connections. If endowment is what you mean by money, you are correct. Your endowment is very small compared to other institutions, understandable for a school from the ENR tradition, but you haven't been that for 30 years, and you're UCC, and you're effectively interdenominational, and you're not going to be able to compete with other mainline seminaries unless you build your capital base, make it substantially larger than it is now. Raising endowments tricky for you. You have to do it in ways that don't have impact on current gifts on which you depend for a sizable part of your revenue stream. But if you can accomplish that, if you can find endowment, and if you can at the same time hold the line on administrative and educational expenditures, if you can also hold the line on the amount you take out of the endowment you've got, remember, no more than 5% in any given year, or you will break Tony Ruger's heart. If you can do all of those things, exercise this kind of stewardship, this seminary is going to be, if not rich, at least adequately poised to face a future which we at Auburn bet with some confidence is going to be much tougher to weather than the period of unprecedented prosperity that we have just been through. So stay disciplined, raise endowment, and you will be okay, provided that you recruit more students. You've had, I'm told, a brief spell of enrollment disappointment, and it may be that this can easily be turned around. Enrollments of most institutions go up and down like this. You never know what a downturn means until you wait for a period of time. I think that your hunch, which was reflected in your materials, your hunch is correct, and that is that admissions success and public relations, and by public relations I mean real relationships, not flashy publicity. Admissions success and authentic relationships to connections with your public will go hand in hand. The students that we surveyed reported to us that the persons who most influenced their seminary choice were the clergy in their congregations. Your future students will come from congregations whose lay and ordained leaders know and trust this seminary. So cultivating congregations and their leaders, as I understand your new alliance project aims to do, that is very good stewardship. At the same time, however, I think you need to prepare, at least prepare mentally, for the possibility that no amount of effort and no kind of effort will bring you enough students. The MDiv and DMin markets are stagnant, absolutely stagnant for mainline Protestants, and they have been for a long enough time that I think we can say that that is the steady state. If that does not change sometime soon, all of us, not just you, but all of the institutions in this business are going to have to face the fact that we have got excess capacity, considerable excess educational capacity for the educational demand. For this school in particular, I can imagine a scenario something like this. And I sketch this out not to alarm you, not to dishearten you, not certainly not to discourage you from the current efforts to build enrollment, but for the larger purpose of pushing you to think about another kind of stewardship. I can imagine a scenario like this. You energetically forge tighter connections with your church constituencies, and that yields you new friends for the seminary, many new friends for the seminary, including some who can make major gifts, and they make them. You continue to earn A's in fiscal management, so you keep this place solid and whole. You maintain your cohesive and dedicated full-time faculty, but still, you don't have enough students, because there simply may not be enough people, at least in your catchment area, who are able to imagine the inestimable rewards of a job that demands so much and pays so little, but that gives a person the privilege of working directly for God. This sketch of one possible future, that everything will be in place here for excellence, except enough students, it leads me to suggest a second step, one that you may never need to take, but I think it would be prudent for you to anticipate nevertheless. I want to suggest that you exercise the far-sighted kind of stewardship of which the rich man proved incapable, that you ask about the future of your valuable resources, faculty, money, buildings, books. Ask the question that the rich man couldn't bring himself to confront, so God had to ask it to him. These things that we have prepared, whose will they be? How few students are too few? If you don't make headway on enrollment, what would you do then? How much expenditure per student would be too much, would be a misuse of your stored up treasures? I think you should begin to think about these questions now, even while you're making every effort, which you should be making, to increase the numbers and quality of students who make the rest of all your hard work worthwhile. And you should go on thinking. If we don't do exactly this, MDiv education, like everybody else, what might our alternatives be in the longer run? There are many kinds of theological education and leadership training required for the rebuilding of religion. And I don't think that thinking about the creative possibilities for that has to be a disheartening prospect. It can be an exciting one. I can give some personal
testimony about alternative forms of theological education and the excitement that's part of them. 60 years ago, the institution that I had was forced by circumstances, including a dearth of students, to change both its location and its program. And I think that since then, Auburn has been a much more valuable contributor to the health and future of the church and the world than we would have been if we had stayed in place and continued as we were. Friends, this work of theological education these days is not easy, and it is not going to get easier. You already know that. You've taken the dim, realistic view. You've acted on it. But ultimately, there is no reason for anything but hope. You already know how to deal with the tough realities. You have the will to do that. You have the means to do it. And more than that, you have one of the most important assignments in the world, which is to equip the leaders of God's people with your mission, your character, your tradition, not to mention your good report card in seminary management, with all the ample blessings that continue to pour on you. You have everything you need, no matter how challenging the future, to be rich toward God. Thank you for having me here. There are many more churches that would like to have pastors than have them. Some of those really can't afford to pay for them, and that's why they don't have them. Others don't because there are fewer persons in the pastorate than there need to be in some denomination, some region, some sector, some types of churches. But the fact that there are jobs there, particularly in this economy where there are jobs everywhere, doesn't mean that people will go to seminary in order to prepare to take those jobs. So even though there's a shortage, and even though in some denominations, sectors, regions, types of ministry, we should be training more people, doesn't mean we'll get them. If this were the other kind of job market where people needed work, we might have a chance, but we're at a very low point in unemployment, and we're not in a good competitive position. And it's deep, and it's cultural. When college students decide what they're going to do, we are not on their screen. And that's a situation that has developed over a long period of time. But getting back into the imaginations of able and caring young people is a huge task. And I don't think that the student situation is going to change until we do it.
Robert, we thank you for being with us, for your very realistic as well as hopeful presentation, and we look forward to talking with you later this afternoon.
Right. Okay.